Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 66, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
Looking very fetching in your Psygnosis t-shirt this week, Ravi.
Oh yeah, I've kind of been buying t-shirts, actually from the Amiga OS podcast.
Oh, okay.
Amigos, yeah, everythingamiga.com. They've got a nice design and I'm a backer, so my name's on it.
Patreon supporter.
Yeah, that's it.
We've had a really busy week. I mean, I've only a couple of days ago got back from a trip in Norway where I went out to see the guys from a Friend Up, we've talked about Friend Up on the show before, but that is it's like a future cloud-based operating system, and a lot of the ex-Commodore guys are working on it, including David Pleasance, Hogner, Paul Lasser, who is used to work on the Commodore 65 and projects like that.
Oh, wow.
I was hanging out with him in Norway over the weekend, so I think I've got him to come on the podcast in a future week as well to give us the inside story on the C65 at some point.
Oh, that's cool. Well, I was local,
you see,
so I didn't have to go that far. And this was at the National Video Game Arcade, so it was the Dizzy Day. And this was the Oliver Twins 30th anniversary of Dizzy.
And a new game came out while you were there as well. The rumours were true.
It did. And as soon as I went in the building, the Oliver Twins saw me and said, "Hey, we're unloading stuff from the car. Get it upstairs." So I was there. We had goodie bags. And I was there with the NVA staff filling goodie bags. So I really earned my little audio clips from them.
Yes, remember, Ravi's worked hard for this interview we've got this week, so we'll do more on that in just a minute. The story about the Mystery World Dizzy release and also the Dizzy Day at the National Video Game Arcade. And also you got your hands on the Vega Plus.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute.
It exists.
It exists. It's real.
So first of all, we've got to say a massive thank you to everyone who supported the show over the last week. These are the people that have gone to theretrohour.com, left a donation to help with the running of the Retro Hour podcast. We appreciate all help. Any penny that we get donated to the podcast goes back into the running of it. And making the Retro Hour Hall of Fame this week, we want to say a massive thank you to Chris Duckers,
Steve Duke,
Ian Pointer,
Richard Halling.
Now, if you want to leave a donation, all you got to do is head to our website. We've made it so easy. You'll find a little PayPal link at theretrohour.com. Now, of course, on this show, as well as giving you the latest goings-on in the world of retro, we often look back as well, and we welcome on a veteran of the video games industry to give us a story of something huge in the history of gaming. And this week, my word, have we got an amazing guest. John Ritman is going to be our guest on the show this week.
Totally, and it's like a kind of 8-bit special, isn't it, today? You know, we've got John Ritman, a new Dizzy game, a Vega. This is interesting stuff.
Yeah, we don't just throw this together.
No.
We do, but it worked out well. But yeah, obviously John Ritman behind games like, what, Batman on the Sinclair Spectrum.
Head Over Heels.
And these are kind of like, you know, some of the first isometric 3D games. And he really pushed the boundaries of what you could do, you know, making these pretty big worlds inside like a Sinclair Spectrum memory space.
Totally. And they were beautiful as well. You know, some of the art behind them and the kind of movement. What was it? Match Day.
Yeah, the football games. Yeah. I mean, you know, in this interview that we've got this week, he's going to tell us why, you know, he still thinks Match Day is more fun than FIFA to this day. And, you know, many would agree, I imagine. And also, he did some really groundbreaking stuff, like having like the first checkpoints in games, which... something everyone takes for granted now, but...
oh, God, dying and then having to go back to the very beginning. It's, like, so frustrating.
Yeah, whenever you play old games, it's like, you're meant to do the whole game in three lives. It's like,
yeah,
it's ridiculous.
One sitting, yeah.
No chance. So John Ritman is going to be our very special guest on the Retro Hour in around 20 minutes from now. So before we get to that, then, let's find out all about this Dizzy Day at the National Video Games Arcade. Now, it happened last Saturday. You were there at the crack of dawn.
Yeah, that was it. I was really early, actually. No one was there till about 12 o'clock. I was just wandering around. But it was great because it meant I got some time in the exhibition on my own. And this exhibition's amazing. It's like a room that's basically the Oliver Twins' bedroom. So even to the point that they've got the curtains from the 1970s, the original ones.
No way.
Their mum and dad had saved them. And they've put them up, and it kind of smells a bit musty, like
teenage boy from the 70s bedroom. Yeah.
And then they've got all their old monitors, including the kind of one that they won, the Commodore monitor that they won on television.
Yeah, because they were on. It was like a TV, like Saturday morning game show.
Gary Newman was on it as well.
And they won a competition to make a video game, didn't they?
Yeah, and they'd already got the kind of console. So they were like, oh, we won a high resolution monitor. So that's sitting there, the original monitor. But they've also got all the maps of how they used to do Dizzy, because they used to draw the levels out and then make little cardboard pieces and then kind of place them on the maps. And once they'd done that, they knew the game was complete.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's all interactive. They've got little QR codes on the pieces. You could put them on a screen and it will come up with like a little clip. It's called Dizzy Vision. And it will come up with clips of old promotions and stuff. And there's hidden little Dizzies everywhere with QR codes.
That sounds amazing.
It's really good.
Well, we had them on the show last summer, didn't we? And, yeah. You know, at the time they were saying then they never throw anything away.
This is...
And luckily, though, they didn't actually throw away the source code to a new Dizzy game. Well, I say new. It was meant to come out 24 years ago. And this was Mystery World Dizzy. Now, a lot of people last week were speculating, you know, is this going to be a new Dizzy game that's going to come out of the event? And it did.
It did. It's a new old Dizzy game, if you know what I mean. And they store things in box files. You know, the traditional square box file kind of thing. And they'd taken this one out and they looked at the map and they were like, we've got all the little markers and pieces on this. This means we've completed this game.
Yeah.
So they'd just forgotten about it in the attic. So they got the disc out, and then the folks at Yoke Folk helped them, because this was yokefolk.com. This was the original source code, but it wasn't compiled or anything. So they helped them compile it and then create an intro for it and, you know, actually get the game working again.
That's pretty amazing, because it is a NES game. And it 1993, I imagine by then the NES was kind of fading away and the Super Nintendo was out.
Yeah.
Maybe that was one of the reasons the game never got released at the time. But this has actually been released on like a proper cartridge with the proper artwork and labels and all that.
Well, they also said it was quite hard with Nintendo at the time, because a third-party release on a Nintendo product, you know, it's kind of hard to do compared to an original Nintendo one. So there might have been a few issues with that.
You know, because everyone thinks of Dizzy as like, you know, being a Spectrum game, really, and obviously Commodore 64 and stuff it got ported to, but, you know, you kind of forget that there was actually Nintendo games and versions of Dizzy, which is pretty cool. And this as well, I mean, you know, if you haven't got a NES lying around in your attic or you don't want to pay for the cartridge, you can actually play this online for free as well.
Oh, yeah, and it's quite nice. It's done in Flash, but even to the point that you can select the controller inputs and kind of have a USB controller and then play it wherever you are on the go.
Yeah, we were playing it before we started the show. That was so late recording this week.
Yeah, but also you can download the ROM there. So if you do have a cart, you can flash it with the updated ROM.
Nice.
So they keep updating it as well for the NES version.
Never thought you'd get that, did you? Real-time digital upgrades for old NES games.
<that's it. laughs>
So if you want to play that, we'll, of course, shove that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, while you're down at the NVA, you actually spoke to a few people, including the Olivers themselves.
Yep.
Now, we do apologise if you get a little bit of mobile phone interference over the top of this interview.
I think I have my audio recorder on my phone a little bit too close. So.
We're going to try and clean it up, but here's a little flavour of the event and the people Ravi spoke to. We'll start with the twins themselves.
This is the Retro Hour, and I'm here with the Oliver twins. How are you doing, guys?
Very well, thank you. Hi, Ravi.
Yes, and this is the 30th birthday of Dizzy, isn't it?
Absolutely. We're not sure we're here exactly to the day, but within a few weeks, because we don't actually have any records of the day that Dizzy released. We used to master the games, take them to Codemasters, usually drive them up, and then a few weeks later we'd see it appear in the shops. So we don't actually have an official day.
It was around Easter.
It was.
1987 is when it first came out.
Ace, and you've actually got an exhibition about Dizzy, which is...
It's
amazing.
It's awesome. I'm here at the National Video Game Arcade in Nottingham. They've set up a Dizzy room. They're using my old bedroom curtains, which is interesting.
And using all the contents of your attic, actually.
Yeah, so they've got everything now. And they've made an amazing display. It's really good. It's going to be open for at least 6 months here. I think quite a lot longer, because it looks really, really good. And they've said that there's only need to replace it when people are not interested in it.
Yeah,
so just stay interested in it.
And as you said, there's loads of old items there. So you've even got the old TV that you won.
I know, that TV's awesome. I mean, we got
it's
that...
It's a monitor, whatever that is.
So, yeah, we got that. We won that in October 83. It did take about 6 months to turn out for Commodore to send it to us. But when it turned up, I mean, it was a brilliant tool, because we were able to plug our Spectrum into that. So that we could see our graphics more clearly when actually developing the games. And we used it till into the 90s.
Yeah, not quite PlayStation. But...
Not quite PlayStation. So 94 probably we stopped using
the Super
it.
NES.
But it's always still worked. It still works to this day. I mean, is it actually running up there?
And
running.
Yeah.
And running. Oh, brilliant!
It's running our game.
Excellent.
Well, last time we spoke to you, you released a book.
Yes.
Now you have a Kickstarter as well.
So so we released the book. The book's gone really, really well. Let's Go Dizzy, the story of the Oliver Twins. And if you haven't read it, you should. It's awesome. I know I say that and it sounds like I'm being a salesman, but actually our money goes to charity anyway. So support charity, for God's sake. Anyway, you actually asked about Kickstarter, so I'm going to return you to that question. So we did the Kickstarter book. Obviously, Chris Wilkins has been organising them. He's done a great job of it. We also, at that time... had our rediscovered game that we found in the loft, which was Wonderland Dizzy, and a Kickstarter was done for that, and those cartridges produced and sent out to the backers, and that went very, very well. We also found another game whilst we were up there. There's a lot of stuff in my attic. We found Dreamworld Pogi, and working with Lukas Kerr in Poland, he managed to recompile that, tidy it up, fix it up.
We can only find discs of source code. And
We can't seem to find final ROMs, which is a bit annoying.
It was a little bit broken, but...
Lucas has fixed it.
Yeah, and we didn't know how the hell to sort of try and get an old NES game working again. It's like
just from source.
Yeah, I think you did have a NES in your attic, but it's like, well, how do you plug this into a PC?
A disc that I can't read, plus a console. There's a few bits in the middle that we need fixing. Anyway, Lucas has done an awesome job. So he got Pogi back up and running. There was a successful Kickstarter that was launched here at the NVA in Nottingham back in December when we did the actual book launch. We had 650 backers, so those cartridges are in production at the moment. In fact, I've just seen a photograph of them this morning showing all the cartridges ready to be sent out, which is awesome. And now... we might find another Dizzy game.
Oh, wow.
It's a funny thing. If you do store everything in your loft and you get into the habit of storing everything, you can never find it. But you do know it's there.
Yeah, exactly. I always knew it was there.
It was
it's
one
just
of the
too
things.
Stuff.
It got prompted by the start of the book. It was like we just made a joke that we've got everything. And it would be good to catalogue.
I mean,
it
took 3 or 4 months of just like every evening and every weekend going up to the loft, first of all, pulling everything down, putting all in my conservatory, and then just going through every box file and going, oh, that's interesting, scan it. Oh, that's interesting, that's in the wrong box, put that over there, put that over there, put it all in the right order. My loft is now looking very tidy, it's looking a lot emptier now because a lot of it's come along here to the museum. So, anyway, the good news is that we did find another finished Dizzy game for the NES. It's called Mystery World Dizzy, and it's now live, and you can play it on mysteryworlddizzy.com. You can download the ROM, stick it on an emulator if you want, but you can just play it on the website. And we are going to do a Kickstarter shortly for real NES cartridges in the full packaging and postage included.
Oh, fantastic.
But we figured we'd get the Pogi, Dreamworld Pogi cartridges shipped out to people before we launch another one.
So I'm at the National Video Arcade, and I've bumped into a Retro Hour listener. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks.
Yeah, what's your name?
My name's Simon.
Simon, and what games have you bought here to get signed by the Oliver Twins?
Well, I bought the original copy of Dizzy for the ZX Spectrum, hoping to get that signed by both of the twins, because it's pretty much one of the first games I ever played on the Spectrum back in the day. That, along with Treasure Island Dizzy, were pretty much like the two games I kept going back to all the time on the Sinclair Spectrum, because once you get through the 6 rubbish Sinclair games that came boxed with it in the original, it's like...
Yeah, and it's that kind of adventure element. You know, you can play it for a very long time. It's got a long life, the Dizzy games.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Back in the days before the internet, so you pretty much had to work out how to complete the games on your own, or you could look at a magazine like about 3 or 4 months down the line when someone's completed it, but... It was an achievement, really, to sit through the game, and also because you didn't have any save games then, so you had to load it up, play it through in one take.
True, yeah, I never thought of that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was even worse with Treasure Island Dizzy, because you literally only had one life in the game. So the slightest little mistake, I mean, you could be playing it for like 2 to 3 hours, and then you just make the wrong jump off... like a cloud or something, where you think, I'm not sure if this is the right way, you jump off and then you land in the lake and drown, and that's the game over. So it was very harsh, but
worth it, definitely.
Worth it, because there's just something about the games that you thought, oh well, you know, I've wasted 3 hours, but I'm gonna have another go, and you kept going at it, and eventually you would get further and further, and it's just that little achievement every time. Even for me, it was like I'd only have an hour or 2 hours after school to play on the Spectrum. So the race to get it loaded and getting as much time as possible to play the game before my mum literally came and unplugged the Spectrum. It's like, no, that's it, bedtime, should unplug it, and no matter where I was in the game, that was it.
So I'm with Stuart Williams from Retro Computer News. How are you doing?
Hi there, Ravi. Good to see you in the flesh.
Yeah. Are you enjoyed today?
It's been a great little event, yeah. Packed out with really keen people, all ages, which is very impressive.
Yeah, totally. And we've also seen another thing today, which is the Spectrum Vega Plus.
Well, yes, it's about rare as hen's teeth, so it goes in line with the eggs theme for today, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And they've also released a new Dizzy game. Well, a new old Dizzy game.
Yeah, Mystery World Dizzy, found lost in a box of discs up in the attic.
Yeah, it's an amazing story, and that's going to be available to play on the website and also to download as a ROM from today.
Yeah, it's all there now, and people can go and have a play with it.
Sounds like you had a really good day.
Oh, yeah, it was amazing. And there was one thing there that I've never seen before, which was a Vega Plus.
A lot of people commenting on our Facebook page now. Just give a little dead quick summary of what the Vega Plus is.
The Vega Plus is a kind of handheld console, which is backed with Clive Sinclair as well, and the Vega people behind it. But also there's been a hell of a lot of drama and kind of dramatic stuff that we haven't really covered because we've not wanted to.
Yeah.
You know, we don't like covering the nasty stuff.
A bit too deep as well.
It's a bit too deep, yeah. So kind of this was a version that was hardware only. It was a prototype. None of the Vega people were there. So we know Jonathan Cordwell, who's one of the Spectrum developers.
Yep.
And he just turned up with this and he was like, look at this. And then there was a few going around and it was really nice. I must say, I'd kind of had my doubts about this project and everything, but these were prototype versions and they were really solid and robust. They felt like a kind of DS or something like that, you know, that quality build.
This is a handheld Spectrum as well.
Yeah. And they've got a beautiful little menu within there that means you can change everything. It's got the games list on it. You know, you can add custom firmware and stuff in there.
You can load games onto it as well, can you?
I think you can.
Okay.
They did say to me, the games list, don't take a photo of it. That's confidential.
Right.
And so I couldn't reveal anything about that. But I'd say there's a little issue, which is the keys on it. They're a little not that responsive, but they're also saying in some of the models are going to change the membranes, which may help. And I think, because a lot of people have been commenting, oh, there's only four or five. Well, no, there's only three in existence. I saw about four or five.
Just at that event?
Well, yeah, because also Jonathan was posting pictures of him with ones with blue backs and red backs, which is kind of nice, different coloured ones. And I guess they were at the National Video Game Arcade because the factory is in Beeston.
In Nottingham.
In Nottingham, where they're building them. So, yeah. But no one was there from the official Vega thing, so we can't give you any dirt on that. We can just talk about the hardware.
Well, that's the thing. So you posted a picture of it. I mean, I was, like I said, in Norway, and I saw it pop up on our Facebook. The first comment was, it was April Fool's Day last week, lads. You know,
yeah.
A lot of people didn't believe this existed at all. They thought it was vaporware or fakes.
Yeah, and a lot of people also think this is like free prototypes that have just been sent around. And I want to make it really clear that kind of the prototypes have been sent out to developers. So there is something in motion.
So we'll keep you up to date on that. But the Vega Plus does exist.
Yeah.
Ravi's held it in his sweaty hands.
Yeah, haven't ruined it yet.
And actually, if you want to see, they did actually record like the live stream and the video of the Oliver Twins talk that they did down there as well, didn't they?
Yeah. And of course, the Oliver Twins had Vega Pluses.
Of course they did. Yeah. Come on, that goes without saying. So if you want to watch that video, it's about an hour long, actually, isn't it, of the Oliver Twins talking at the NBA.
Yeah.
We'll put that in the show notes this week at theretrohour.com. Right, then moving on. 21 things we miss about old computers. And this is a list. We do like these kind of list format articles, don't we?
Yeah.
Gives us something nice to talk about. And this is published on denofgeek.com. And they've actually done like a kind of a tongue-in-cheek list of things that, you know, we miss about old machines. Stuff that, you know, maybe we took for granted back then. Some of them I don't necessarily agree with, if I'm honest. First one on the list is loading games off cassette tape.
I never did that. You know, I was 5.5-inch floppies, you know.
You're posh.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, anyone that owned Commodores and Spectrums back then, you had like an Amstrad PC, didn't you, your first machine?
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't the most enjoyable thing in the world, especially when, I mean, you got the kind of, you know, some games were really cool and they give you like music when they were loading. You know, some of the really advanced ones, you've even got like a game to play,
yeah,
like a pre-game while the actual game's loading. But the most annoying thing I remember was when you get multi-part loaders. So say, for example, it was a pretty big game and the full game wouldn't fit into memory. So you'd finish level one, then it'd have to load the next level. That'd take about 15 minutes. Then if you died, rewind the tape, load it in again. It was like, this is something I'm not nostalgic for.
Well, I'd say I've just like had a wave of nostalgia, and it was this kind of when I was a kid, I'd stolen a load of my brother's cassettes, and I just to make my own mixtapes.
Yeah,
and then I put it in, and it got
like, data on it.
Yeah, data. I was like, "What the hell is this?" Yeah.
What did your brother have?
I think it was an Atari.
Yeah, okay. Maybe an Atari 400 or something like that. So you didn't tape over his games, did you?
Yeah, I did a few.
If your brothers are listening, then yeah, can beat Ravi up after the show. Next one is low-res graphics. Now, I kind of do see where they're coming from with this one. It kind of used your imagination a little bit more, I guess, didn't it? Having to kind of work out what it was. And, you know, they're talking here, the original Space Invaders. It was just, you know, essentially it was black and white graphics overlaid, you know, coloured plastic on the screen. But it really got your heartbeat going and stuff like that because, you know, it didn't have to be amazing photorealistic graphics to get your imagination going.
Totally. Yeah.
So agree with that one. Next one. And this, I'd actually completely forgotten about this. And this is something that was so big back in the day that you never see now. High score tables.
High score tables, God, yes. The amount of swear words and owners of shops getting really annoyed that some kid had put a swear word in and trying to erase it. Yeah, high scores. Oh, God, I'd forgotten about that totally. That was a massive thing, wasn't it?
That was one of the main reasons, wasn't it, to keep pumping money in because, yeah, in your local chippy, you want to get that swear word at number one.
Yeah, I guess the kind of internet leagues are now the high score tables of the future.
Do you remember they used to do it in magazines as well? People could write in with their high scores, but...
Well, yeah, there's a few gaming competitions online, actually, where you do high scores and people submit their results, you know, screenshots of the original game. It's quite cool.
I'm not sure how they verified it back in the day, where you had to take a photo with, like, your mum's Polaroid and or get it sent off to get developed and all that. But they took your word for it, probably, you know what I mean?
That's it.
The next one is the sounds, which there's actually a picture in this article of Pro Tracker.
Oh.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, we don't need to really say much more on that. You know, how amazing was like 8 and 16-bit music. This one as well, which I think, you know, we've talked about this on the show in, you know, over the last year that we've been doing this, learning to program.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
But I think that's kind of coming back now, isn't it, with stuff like the Raspberry Pi and...
I think people want to see how stuff works more. Mm-hmm. And what's it called now? Recycling's called upscaling.
Yeah.
And programming's probably got a new fancy name as well, but it's essentially the same. Hackspace, that's it, something like that.
Well, it's a thing. I mean, you know, old machines, they dumped you into BASIC, didn't they? And I always remember when I first got my Amiga after my Plus 4, I was like, well, where's the programming language? You know, I mean, it was actually a bit of a shock. You had to go and buy it separately. I was like, what's this?
God, I remember my friend, you know, we'd be on the Amiga and it would be all GUI.
Yeah.
And then I went onto his PC and it was DOS. It's like, well, we have to type in commands.
Don't know how lucky we had it, do we, later on? And the last one on the list, which I know will resonate with you, Revy, Playground Piracy.
Oh, yes, definitely. still continue.
You're a good boy these days.
Yeah, I'm a good boy. I use a VPN.
But, you know, back in the day, I remember... you know, being the coolest kid at school because I had, you know, certain games before anybody else. I think I mentioned on the show before that my uncle actually had a guy he worked with who would call up all those dodgy bulletin boards in Sweden and Finland and all that. And, you know, my uncle would give him a fiver and we'd get the latest discs, you know, hot off the press, as it were.
Well, yeah, with me it was different waves. So it was like, you know, first we'd do floppy disk and then the PlayStation came out. So it was all CD-ROMs and then... HTTP came out, so it was all Google briefcases and all of this, and then Napster came out, and it was just,
You know, we're not saying it's big or clever, but, you know, a lot of us did it back in the day. But I think, you know, they do make a good point in this article that these days it's a lot easier to pay for stuff. Obviously, you know, we've got a bit more money now, we're adults. But also, you know, because thanks to stuff like the indie scene, there is affordable games that you can get for, like, you know, a couple
of quid. Like, I used to absolutely hate Steam when I was younger. I was like, why are you guys paying for games? You know, you can download them all. But if I look at my Steam library now, it's massive.
Yeah.
And that's because of stuff like bundles and discounts and, you know, kind of the wish list where it'll pop up and say, oh, this special's on sale.
And affordable price is not like taking the mickey, innit?
Totally.
So, if you want to see this list, there's 21 of them. We'll shove those in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, speaking of Steam, a new old game that is coming to Steam. And this was, obviously, we've had Mike Montgomery from the Bitmaps on the show before.
Oh, yeah.
A Bitmap Brothers classic is coming back for the 21st century. Now, if I play the theme music, you might recognise it.
The wonderful, wonderful, wonderful.
Oh, yes.
Into the wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Into the wonderful, wonderful.
Okay, so do you know much about this tune?
The wonderful.
I know, I loved it.
Yeah.
Go on, give us a story then.
So this is Nation 12, okay, which was a group with John Fox. And John Fox was from Ultravox.
Oh, by Vienna.
Yeah,
oh,
but he actually left before Vienna. So he was on Ultravox.
Just before that big hit.
Yeah, yeah, basically. So he was kind of like, you know, the guy who didn't make it. But he was like the poor man's Gary Newman.
Right.
That's what they'd say. But okay, he did Gods, and he did a whole album. And it was called Nation 12. That was a little group. And they did dual releases where they released Amiga songs and vinyl.
Okay.
So you can get this Nation 12 album that's all kind of Gods and stuff like that. What was Speedball 2?
Yeah.
You did that as well.
So. Oh, that was great music on that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is with, I think I would load that game up and just, listen to the intro music while
Yeah, yeah, just bouncing around, yeah, because it was actual, like, a commercial release, that quality.
Yeah, yeah, it was awesome. Well, Gods is a game that's getting a remake, an HD upgrade. Now, this is in cooperation with Mike Montgomery, of course, one of the original Bitmap Brothers, one of the founders, and a team called Sound of Games. Now, obviously, it came out on the Amiga, the Atari ST. I think it was a DOS version of it as well back in the day. And this is going to be coming out in the third quarter of 2017. As you'd expect from, an HD upgrade. I think they've actually done a good balance between remaining faithful to the original game, but also giving it kind of, really smooth, high-resolution look as well. You've watched a trailer, haven't you, that I posted before?
Yeah, yeah, and it's I kind of like the chucking. That's what I've always liked in that game, is when you're chucking the knives and the way...
Yeah, they've got the movement right.
Yeah, exactly the same. That's good. The graphics, they seem okay, but you've got to remember this is a early version, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I've been chatting to the guys on Facebook and they said this is still a work in progress, stuff can change, because they have had some people criticising them. I think unfairly, though, because some people are saying, the graphics are not that great, but then again, they're trying to bring a 16-bit game into the modern world. If you change it too much, it loses everything that made the original game, memorable.
Because I've seen a lot of remakes, like the Agony remake as well and stuff, and that was of a similar kind of ilk. The graphics looked very similar.
Yeah, well, it's kind of got, it's really nicely textured 3D, proper lighting and effects and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, dynamic lighting and stuff like that.
And there is going to be a mobile version. I think the video, we'll put this trailer in our show notes at theretrohour.com. It's actually a mobile version that they're showing in the video.
So. Oh, wow. Okay, cool. And that changes things a lot. If that's a mobile version, that would look a lot better. I was thinking this was for the main PC one, but if they've got mobile, wow.
Now they're saying the PC version is going to be even more enhanced. So,
Should
look a lot shinier. Hopefully it'll get console releases as well. I know at the moment it's PC on Steam and mobile they're talking about.
Yeah.
But, we'll keep you up to date with this. I think it's always cool when classic games get, a remake for the 21st century.
And Gods was really good. I love that game.
It was one of those games where it was pretty simplistic, really. It was just like a side-scrolling platformer, really, wasn't it? But it was the atmosphere of the game I liked.
Yeah, I like the sound effects as well. All that kind of stuff.
That is one point as well. I hope they do like a modern version of the theme tune.
Oh, yeah. That's got to be done. They can't have a total different tune. Yeah, get John Fox back on it.
Yeah, yeah. If you need hooking up, Ravi can, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. John Fox and the Maths. That's his new band.
So thank you for checking out episode number 66 of the Retro Hour podcast. There is still time as well to vote for us in the British Podcast Awards. It's getting very close now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And we've got to beat Edith Bowman. So, guys. Yeah.
Not literally, of course. That'd be awful. If we make the headlines the next day, it wasn't us. So, of course, if you do want to vote for us, guys, we appreciate this. We're up for, we put ourselves in the nominations for the Listener's Choice Award. I think this is all based on numbers as well, isn't it? And like we said last week, if everyone who listened to this voted for us, we'd have a good chance of making the top 10, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So just head to theretrohour.com/vote and type in the Retro Hour.
That's it. Take you 5 seconds.
Yeah.
So thanks for checking out this week's show. We'll be out again next Friday. Your little treat before the weekend. Have an amazing Easter bank holiday weekend if you're celebrating that this weekend. And now we're going to get seriously nostalgic for the 8-bit days with this week's special guest, the fantastic John Rittman. And we'll see you next week.
Ciao.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and let's get on this week's special guest. Joining us on the phone right now, John Rittman, thanks for coming on.
No problem.
Now, we're going to get some amazing stories, I'm sure, from your many years developing video games, but I thought it would be really interesting to start your story right at the beginning. So, do you remember the first time you ever experienced a computer or a game then? What's your earliest memory?
Of a computer? That would be when I was 15 and I was visiting my brother in Brussels, and he worked for Singer, the sewing machine people.
Right.
And was their head of computing. I was just a kid, he's quite a lot older than me. There was this huge room full of giant Winchester discs and reel-to-reel spinning stuff. And all I can remember was he said to me, showed me a keyboard and said, type anything you want. And so, you know, not really knowing what to type, I typed my name. And suddenly this enormous meter-wide line printer word into action and started spewing paper, and my brother's yelling, "What have you done? What have you done?" I told him I'd type my name in, and he said, "Oh, I named a program after you."
So you'd loaded this program up then, inadvertently.
Yeah.
Wow, so did that kind of capture your imagination then, using that machine?
No, not really. It was just a weird thing that happened.
So when did you eventually get into like computers at home then, and what was your first system?
Right, so when I became a grown-up, I was working for Radio Rentals, the TV rental company, and was a television engineer. This was 1980-81. We just got our first video recorders in, and they started talking about renting out computers. They were talking about the Atari at the time. I can't remember which one. Mm-hmm. And I'd already noted that the people who'd been on special courses to learn how to repair the video recorders were earning more than me. And I thought, maybe I should learn about these computers before we get them in. So I went and bought a ZX81, which was just being released at that moment. And so that was my first computer.
I hear you kind of lived inside the ZX81 manual for quite a while.
It was a strange thing for me because, it's great. It was a great manual. I mean, I put down my career to the people that wrote that manual because it was so easy to grasp. And I taught myself BASIC inside a week. I mean, I went right the way through the manual in a week. You know, that's after work, so each evening. And at the end of that, I thought, okay, what's next? Machine code. And went out and bought my first book on machine code. So that was after having it a week. There was a fellow engineer at Radio Rentals who'd bought a Commodore PET, and he'd learned almost nothing. And when he showed me the manual, I could see why.
Yeah.
I mean, it really didn't make any attempt to teach you.
So what kind of stuff were you doing on your ZX81 then? Was it mainly programming that you did on it?
I mean, that's all I did. I just taught myself to program. It was just a fun thing to learn to do. And being an engineer, electronics engineer, the mindset is very similar, particularly when it comes to finding errors in your program. Mm. You know, when you're mending a television, you're basically saying, I've got a signal coming in through the aerial wire, and I've got a picture on the front of the screen. And if there isn't a picture on the front of the screen, there is somewhere between the two, there is a fault. And basically, the smart way to find it is to do a binary search, where you go halfway through the process. And is it working up to here? Then you know which half it's working on. And you do it again. You go halfway in, and you keep doing that until you find it. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what you do when you're debugging a program.
So what kind of programs were you writing then? Was it like games? Was it applications? What kind of stuff?
I should go back a bit. Not only had I that I should learn about computers for my job, but I was also trying to justify how I was going to use the computer because it was quite a lot of money. It was a week's wages. So I remember writing a list which had things like keep a list of my albums on it, things like that. Never actually happened. And by the time I got to machine code, I thought, well, what else can I do? I suppose I'll write a game.
So what was your kind of first title that you started working on?
Well, it ended up being called Namtier Raiders. I had no idea that assemblers existed. I was literally doing it by hand, writing it down on sheets of paper, converting it to hex, working out all the jumps that had to be made and the addresses. It was incredibly laborious. And I'd been doing it for, I don't know how long, several weeks. And then some magazine advertised an assembler. I was like, never heard of these before. That sounds a good idea. So I went out and bought one and carried on with that. But, I had to start again, basically, and just type it all in as mnemonics rather than hex. Nancy Raiders was born about 2 months later.
How did that game kind of get attention then?
I just sent it off to three companies, as I remember. One of them was Arctic. They came back to me pretty much immediately, within 2 days, and offered me a silly amount of money for it, which I stupidly accepted.
And a kind of theme that you had with your games, like, I noticed you went to 3D Combat Zone after that, and it was this kind of early attempts at 3D?
It was really a case... Look, I wasn't being very clever on my first few games. I wasn't being creative. I was simply copying things I'd seen. And, you know, happy that I was actually capable of doing that. We had a local burger bar near my house, and when myself and friends got together... invariably, somebody would wander off to the burger bar at some point with a big order, and they had a Battlezone machine there. So we all played it, I love Battlezone. I played it recently at a retro event, and somebody had an original machine there, and it's great. So I wanted to make it, and it was something to learn, because I didn't even pass my maths O level, so training myself to do 3D maths was an interesting adventure.
Well, you mentioned arcades there. I mean, you know, Battlezone's one of those games that has held up really well, you know, from the old days. I mean, were there any other, like, arcades or games that you played at home that influenced you in the early days?
Certainly seeing Ultimate early products had an influence on me. I wanted, you know, after I saw Jetpack I just wanted to go for something a bit more colourful, and that's why, you know, I ended up doing Bear Bobber.
That was quite an interesting concept as well, because it was kind of an electric car, wasn't it? And you had to go round and collect all the batteries.
Yeah, but it was stolen again. It was Burger Time, Mattel's Burger Time, which I'd seen at work on the Atari. And I kind of stole the concept, and Clive Sinclair was talking about electric cars at the time, and I thought, let's tie the two together.
Well, that's come around now. It could probably be a Tesla or something.
Slightly more creative in that I was doing things that weren't exact copies, but I still wasn't there in making my own mark on invention.
I think that was very common around that time, though, wasn't it? That people would, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, people would make various clones of Pac-Man and just call it something slightly different. I mean, no one really caught on to the fact, you know, of copyright really all that much back then, did they?
They didn't, no. It was quite funny to watch the gradual change. And I particularly noticed it many, many years later when late 90s, in a soccer game, and suddenly everybody was really paranoid about using names. Of what you named the players. People wanted a signed bit of paper saying you could use a particular name, which, you know, you weren't going to get from a top professional footballer without paying him a load of money, which is why one of my soccer games went out in the 90s with the centre-forward of Brazil as John Rittman.
Even on Bear Booth, the song was Teddy Bear's Picnic, so you kind of used a semi-copyrighted thing.
I don't know if that was copyrighted or not by then. Well, it might have been out of date.
Yeah, that was an interesting use, and I always remember kind of hearing little tunes in Spectrum and C64 games that would, you know, kind of be very similar.
Well, I guess nursery rhymes you probably could use without any fear of that, couldn't you?
Yes, you probably could. I mean, you know, they do run out, but, hey, it was only quite recently Happy Birthday came out.
Yeah, like last year or something, wasn't it?
Something like that.
Well, moving on to Match Day, why did you decide to go with, like, an isometric side view for that game?
Simply because it... You know, I'd seen international soccer on the Commodore in shop windows, I could see how it worked. You know, it gave you something that was feasible to do on a pretty slow computer, and allowed you to see, to some extent, in 3D, in terms of knowing where the ball was in height and where it was on the pitch. You know, with, by putting a shadow on the pitch, you got a lot of visual information about where the ball was going, and that just worked for me.
Well, I remember seeing international soccer. I mean, it was pretty groundbreaking when that game came out, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was in, you know, every shop window. And basically what happened was I went to a fair and went round and talked to the distributors, and they were all saying they wanted international soccer on the Spectrum, mm-hmm. or something like that. I very deliberately never played it until after I'd finished match day, because I didn't want to do an exact copy.
I remember that was the one game that everybody always had on cartridge on the Commodore 64 for some reason.
Well, there were huge adverts. I can remember 40-foot posters up in the street. You know, they really pushed it.
I heard that you actually reused some of the Bear Bother sprites in that game too.
Kind of, yeah. started, you know, changed them a bit. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't a great graphic artist, and it probably showed. And the thing was that the Bear Bother ones had been done very carefully to try and avoid colour clash, which, of course, didn't really matter on match day because you were only using a couple of colours. But on Bear Bother, particularly when you're climbing ladders, that was a real problem of how to avoid the colour clash. And so their movement was very controlled around that. So as they climbed a ladder, basically only their arms would move, and then their body would move very suddenly to get the animation smooth with the colour.
Well, you also had some, as you mentioned, team names. You had some quite creative ones there. I think there was an ocean team.
It was, I just used friends, you know, Kev's Cosmos and such like, Rickman Rovers was there.
Nice. And your game was also included in a 1986 compilation. They sold a million too. Did that kind of help spread it and establish your...
We sold a lot of it just on its own, and then pretty much the same again on They Sold a Million, which of course I hadn't. That was just a name. So I probably with the two together, it was in excess of 100,000, which for those days was very good.
Well, I remember playing Batman, and that was obviously an isometric game as well. Was that kind of an officially licensed game, I take it, then? I mean, how did you get the license for that?
Right, story behind Batman. So, basically, I handed over Match Day to David Ward at Ocean, the final copy. Immediately afterwards, he passed me a game and said, you need to look at this. And it was Nylor. And I went round to some friends' house round the corner from Ocean, and we put it on, and they were in the games industry too, and, you know, multiple jaws hit the floor. You know, it's what I'd always wanted, a Disney film that you could play. Mm-hmm. That's how I saw it. And so I immediately started trying to work out how it was done, and did work that out. I knew my artwork wasn't up to it. So I got Bernie Rounds, who was a friend who doodled all the time, you know, just like all the time, and sat him in front of the computer and found he could do it, and then sat down with him one day and said, look, we need to hang this on something, something to give it some a name that people will really recognise. And I was going through things like the Greek gods and Norse gods, things like that. And then I thought of Batman and immediately dismissed it because, for me, Batman was the 60s series, which, of course, was quite a long time before.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, nobody will remember that. And Bernie immediately piped up, oh, yeah, it's being re-shown on Channel 4. All the kids are watching it. Bernie used to play football with a bunch of kids over his local park pretty much every day. So he knew this. So he knocked up a graphic, a simple animation. I took it up to Manchester and showed David Ward, and they just said, "Yeah, we'll sort out the license," and they did, and that was it. And we and DC Comics had virtually no input into the game at all. With one thing that in the final blurb, which I'd knocked up in 20 minutes when I'd finished the game, I'd called the power-ups bat pills, and they objected to that because Batman doesn't take drugs. And so we changed it to bat powers, and they were quite happy.
Well, obviously, I mean, you were kind of a couple of years ahead of the curve because, you know, like, what was that, 86 that came out, didn't it? So, I mean, 89, you know, obviously the Michael Keaton movie came out and Batman was like the biggest thing in the world, wasn't it, just a few years after?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, so we were running off the 60s dodgy series, and then it took off after that.
Yeah, I bet it had been more expensive to license in 89 than 86.
Just a bit, yeah.
One thing that was amazing about that game, I mean, you know, it had a fully isometric 3D world, which, you know, doing that on the Spectrum, was that quite a challenge?
Yes, I suppose it was. It was just something, a bit of programming. Every bit of programming at that time was a challenge. You know, every day I was doing stuff that there was a large chance that nobody in humanity had ever done before in the history of mankind, because mm-hmm. that's where we were, at the forefront of invention. We were constantly trying to come up with new ways of doing things and having to make them up as we went along. Everything you did was pushing limits and doing things that you weren't meant to do. A classic would be something that would have been highly frowned upon in the professional programming world, and that's self-modifying code, where the code modifies itself to run differently. And yet, if I could squeeze a few more cycles out of that, I wouldn't hesitate to do it.
Well, you also created kind of a checkpoint system, or a system where you wouldn't, you know, go all the way to the beginning of the game and have to start again. And that was fairly innovative for the time.
Yeah, I suppose it was. Did Match Day 1 have something like that? I can't remember. Did Match Day 1 have a code entry? I know Match Day 2 did. The idea that you could, you know, not have to go all the way back. Too big a game for that.
The game was very successful because it got to number 2 in the charts. That must have been something you're really proud of, was it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a bit of luck. I was of the opinion that a game was finished when it was finished, not when some artificial deadline was made. So I didn't do deadlines. That I had in common with Ultima. They likewise had the same opinion. And as such, I had a bad bit of missing Christmas, which, of course, everybody wanted to get a game out for. So the result is I would probably hit Easter. And that actually proved quite advantageous because nobody else was aiming for Easter. In addition, nearly every artist on the magazines had probably grown up drawing things like Batman. And so when Batman was released, I walked into my local Smith's to see a whole row of magazines with Batman all over the cover, because every artist thought, "Oh, wow, I can draw Batman for the cover."
You know, waiting for those magazines' reviews of your games then, was that quite a nerve-wracking experience, like going into WH Smith's and then, you know, flicking to the page?
I used to use it. It's funny, you know, sometimes I put things off. One of my putting off procedures was to go for the down to Wood Green in North London, pick up some magazines. It was just a way of avoiding doing any work, really. And then I'd go home and read them. And yeah, you know, most of my reviews at that time were really good. So it was disappointing if I got a poor one, but they were never that bad.
Well, the next game that you created was Head Over Heels, and did that use the same engine as Batman, or did you kind of improve it?
It used almost the same engine. I basically did a load of work while putting off the one thing that I knew had to be done because I wasn't quite sure how I was going to do it. And that's the ability to maintain, in effect, two rooms. Because if you think in Batman, the room is stored in a very tight fashion in memory. And then when you actually go into the room, that room is expanded in memory, and then you can start moving things around. But if you leave the room, you don't store where everything has moved to. If you go back in there, it's all returned to its starting place as it re-expands the tight memory version of it. So in Head Over Heels, I had to keep rooms when you weren't in them, because if you swapped between head and heels, you had to maintain the other room. So I just kept putting that off because I wasn't sure how to do it. And in the end, there was nothing else to do in the programming side before I started creating the map apart from that. So I had to, you know, force myself to do it, and it must have taken me all of 40 minutes.
Oh, wow. Because that's a really innovative concept, the kind of way that you can control two elements in the same space. And
I know it was hailed as something really different. And the funny thing is, I didn't think of it as that. I thought of it in an entirely different way. In Batman, for instance, I thought that you need to get... It's great to earn abilities when you're playing a game. To start off with something that's relatively ineffective, and then to gain the ability to do something is something that every game player enjoys. So what I did in Batman was decide everything that I wanted Batman to do, and then I took a load of them away. So when you first got Batman, he couldn't jump. He couldn't, you know, he couldn't carry things. You had to find something, and that earned you that ability. And as far as I was concerned, making two players was exactly the same thing. It was just one more step in that, you know, the final version would be to join the two players together, and then you had all the abilities in one place. So that's how I saw it. And I didn't really think of it as something particularly innovative, but other people did. I suppose it was, but I wasn't thinking that at the time.
Oh, and it was a massive game as well. You know, you had 300 rooms in there.
It was there was a lot of quite clever compression in the way the map was stored. I believe the average space for a room going for, I don't know, 301 rooms was 17 bytes. Think of today's web pages and how many web pages you could store in 17 bytes.
It's not even a button, is it?
No.
Well, in that game, I mean, a robot controlled by push switches had quite a resemblance to Prince Charles with a Dalek's head on, I used to read at the time. I mean,
although Bernie, who drew it, says it was actually Pug from the Bash Street Kids.
Did you get any stick for that at the time then, or did it cause much controversy?
Do you know, I have seen, if you search around on the internet, you'll find it. There is a serious bit of university work about all the connotations of Head Over Heels and, you know, the comments on the English monarchy. It's written by somebody Dutch, I believe. But in a university, there's a serious bit of work.
Wow.
So much bullshit, I can't believe it.
I mean, were you a fan of, like, Monty Python or, like, surrealism, or did you just, enjoy making kind of out there kind of things?
Like stairs made of dogs and stuff like that.
Well, my instructions to Bernie for graphics were draw me something that looks fantastic. And we soon realised that you couldn't, with pixels the size they were on the spectrum, you couldn't keep things in scale and have them look fantastic. But, you know, you just can't. So having a cup of tea that's half the size of Batman was acceptable to me because it just looked great. And yeah, that made it quite surreal, but what the hell? It's a game.
Yeah, totally. And you also it was ported to a lot of systems. Did you have any hand in the porting?
Oh, yeah. The thing was, when Match Day 1 was released, Ocean got a version of it made on the Amstrad by some company. And I have this horrific memory of phoning them up and going, do you understand how the effect on the ball that the direction the men are running has when it hits them? And their answer was, we don't really care, mate, we're just doing this job. And I just thought, oh, all the care I put into thinking about that and planning it, and you're just blowing it out the window. And of course, their version was crap. And I just thought, that's never happening again. And I want complete control over every version that's ever made of any of my games. And so all the Z80 games I wrote myself, and the 6502 versions were done with line-by-line conversions with me involved throughout. So somebody else would do the conversion, but they'd be on the phone to me all the time. We'd debug together where I was looking at the Z80 codes and they were looking at the 6502 codes to make sure they behaved in the same way.
I imagine you did quite a lot of bug testing, but there was one bug that made it through in that game.
In Head Over Heels, yes, there was a bug, yeah. Nobody ever noticed it until a mate of mine came round and he said, "Can I play it?" And I said, "Sure, I'm just going down to a newsagent to get something." I can't remember what. Newsagent was only about 20 yards away. When I come back, the game was frozen. I'm like, "What the hell did you do?" So I played it again and it happened again. I was just like, "Oh, wow." And then I looked at the code and I could see what had happened. But nobody ever reported it apart from that.
Oh, wow. So it's not like today you can just push an update, is it? You know, once it's out there, it's out there.
Yeah, it was just this, you know, so strange thing that I'd overlooked, where if you went into a room and then swapped to the other character and he went into a room and then you went swapped back and the guy died. So it was something like that, that it could lock up. Oh, well, at least we didn't get any complaints.
Well, that game, obviously, I mean, it got, like, some really good scores in the magazines. Like, 97%, I think, they got in Crash magazine, which, you know, was ridiculously high in the magazine, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was quite pleased with that. Even better was having Head Over Heels, Batman and Match Day 2 in the chart, in their Crash readers' chart simultaneously in the top 10.
Oh, like Michael Jackson. Yeah, so the next game you moved on to was Match Day 2. Did you feel you kind of had to improve the Match Day series? Or?
Yeah, Match Day 2, well, I knew it could be done better and I enjoyed doing it and I enjoyed playing Match Day, so thought I'd have another go. Better graphics, Bernie doing the graphics, better gameplay, more variety, more competition options. You know, in particular, things like collision detection. You know, Match Day 1 was the first time I'd really had to deal with collision detection where it affected something. You know, it's very different from shooting a bullet at something and it exploding when it hit something. To have the ball react when it hit a player was a very different sort of collision detection. And you know, had to understand what the player was doing as well as the ball. And I knew that I could improve greatly on what I had. And I thought, you know, if you play football, people use their bodies. You know, if a ball's coming in at chest height, you kind of pull back from it to stun it, to try and get control over it so it doesn't bounce off too fast. Alternatively, if you're going in with your head, you're probably going towards it to try and get, you know, the maximum velocity off you. And I wanted to bring that into the game. Well, that's what I did.
You had the first kind of kickometer as well, or like, you know, power bar when you kicked. Yeah, that was an interesting idea. Why did you come up with that?
Oh, I just wanted more variety. I mean, you know, and I realised that it could overcomplicate things, and hence the reasons that the front end allowed you to set precisely what you wanted the meter to do, you know, what kicks you wanted available, you know, allowed the player to set that up. And it was quite fun. We'd have to do back heels and things like that.
Well, how did you figure out the AI for Match Day 2 then? Because, I mean, that was massively improved over the original, wasn't it?
Yeah, would have been. I should explain that on Match Day 1, I didn't have the faintest idea how to do AI. I mean, I really didn't. So I basically finished the game in terms of being able to play a match and had no AI at all. And it was terrifying me. You know, I just did not know what to do. And you know, finally I get once again to that stage where there's nothing else to do and I have to face it. And so I got all the stuff that you could play human to human. So, you know, players would run around into position, which was I suppose you could call that AI, but that would be stretching the point. And I thought, okay, now I have to write something where they actually are controlling the joystick, in effect. The computer is controlling the joystick. And I started at the simplest level where I put a bit of code that said, have you got the ball? If you haven't got the ball, run towards it. If you have got the ball, kick it up the field. That was the first bit of AI I ever wrote. And I stuck it in the program. I spent about 10 lines of code, and it scored against me in about 30 seconds. And I simultaneously laughed and cried for about half an hour. it was absolutely fantastic. And, needless to say, by the time I did the second one, I was getting a bit more sophisticated.
Well, that's why they said it was a, really kind of addictive game, because it was quite hard to play against the AI, it's a challenge.
Well, it's a bit of a challenge. Depends how well you know it, doesn't it? I think my record was about 22-0 or something.
I mean, obviously, that was very well received as well. I recall it got to number two in the charts, just behind Outrun, which obviously was a massive game, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It did very well. I was really pleased with that. There is a slight story on that, in that the guy that did the cover art, Bob Wakelin at Ocean, his way of doing art was he'd often find a photograph and then paint over it. That's what he'd done for match day. So when I was on my way back from Manchester, having delivered the final copy of Match Day 2, I went to Ludlow to crash and went to show them the game. And walked into the office and they said, oh, we've just had another game out. Another football game. It's nowhere near as good as this, but here, come and look. They took me around the corner and there was a poster hanging on the wall for it, Gary Lineker's Superstar Soccer.
Yeah.
And blow me down if it wasn't the same picture.
And he just kind of painted it then, I think.
He'd got a picture of Gary Lineker and he painted over it and it was the same bloody picture. And nobody ever noticed and I just kept my mouth shut.
I don't blame you. That could have caused some confusion on the shop shelves, couldn't it?
Just a little, yeah.
I mean, there have been some like kind of classic games, like Kickoff's been kind of brought into the new era recently. I know Dino's like updated that. I mean, are there any plans to ever bring back the, do like an HD update of Match Day?
No, I don't think so. I tell you what, we did a version of Match Day 3 in 97.
Yeah.
Which then, for various really stupid reasons, got renamed. And it was at a time when, FIFA and its ilk ruled the roost. Obviously, they're very different sorts of games. And I'll take you way back to the first ever FIFA. I went into a shop to just have a chat into a computer game shop. The guys there knew me and they said, oh, we've got this new game in. And so they put it on for me and I started playing it. And I thought, there's something weird about this. And I felt like I was doing too well, considering it was my first game.
Mm-hmm.
And so I shut my eyes and I scored. Okay, so I'm not actually playing this. He's playing it for me. And that's the way that the football games have changed.
Hmm.
Now, I wanted a game that I controlled. But, that when I was successful, it was because I'd made it happen. I had a learning curve. It took you a long time before you were going to score with an overhead kick. As an example, and that's the sort of game I would create. And the soccer game sort of went the other way. They were just play, hence pass buttons. Whereas I was putting a ball into space and having players run onto it. It was just passing to somebody. They weren't even really controlling who. And the journalists, by the time the Match Day 3 game was released, the journalists were used to that. And they couldn't be bothered to learn. And so most of the reviews were pretty naff. And I thought, OK, so that has changed. And probably not an area I want to play in anymore.
Yeah, so FIFA these days, you can just by button mashing, you can play it, can't you, really?
Yeah, I've stopped playing.
When did you eventually get out the Spectrum scene then? What made you kind of quit working on the Spectrum?
Well, I saw a big interview with Chris and Tim Stanker from Ultima, and they were looking for people to work at Rare. And I just thought I'd be quite interested in doing some work with them. You know, I had an enormous amount of respect for them. I'd never met them because they didn't really talk to the press much and get out there at shows or anything like that. So I gave Crash a ring, I think, and just said, can you get me their number? They did, and I went to visit them. And then I worked with them for a few years. Things like Donkey Kong Country and that thing like that were written on my DevTools, Assembler, Monitor, Debugger, and did the game on the Game Boy.
Is that Monster Max?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, your isometric format fitted in really well on that game, didn't it? Into the handheld
market. I thought it worked quite well on the Game Boy, actually. I think it was quite nice. It got some tremendous reviews, but unfortunately the company that was marketing it failed to get it onto the shelves and at the same time as the reviews by a factor of about 10 months.
You were offered to have it published by Nintendo at one point, weren't you?
Only if I changed all the characters to Nintendo style. Had I known what I know now, I would have jumped at it.
Was it Titus who published it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And that was with Rare as well. So kind of what was it like meeting up with Rare in those early days?
Oh, God, I started working with Rare. It was great. I mean, I got on with most of my dealings with Chris Stamper. I got on with him like house on fire. We would frequently be chatting at 3 a.m. For an hour or so because we both worked through the night. Really good fun.
You know, doing games for the Game Boy, I mean, obviously that used a Z80 as well. I mean, did you kind of use, like, a lot of your knowledge from the Spectrum on that?
A castrated Z80. A castrated Z80, not a Z80.
Cut down.
You know, and both its balls chopped off and a fair bit more. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you had to do all sorts of different things. No, it was why they couldn't have just used a Z80 is beyond me.
That's Nintendo. Was it a frustrating platform to work on then, was it, that I take it?
Well, a little bit. I had the advantage that I'd written my development platform by then. So that was the first game I'd done with it, and that was in itself a revelation. I could do things with that dev kit that I'd never been able to do before, and it made writing a game far, far easier.
Well, looking back on those days, I mean, would you say you had, like, one machine that was kind of your favourite of, like, you know, maybe the 80s or the 8-bit generation?
I'm just going to say the Spectrum, simply because it was, you know, the first one and it was such an adventurous time. You know, it was a bundle of fun to just sit down and just go, what shall I make today that nobody else has done?
Were you involved with the PC remake of Head Over Heels?
Oh, yeah, so that was somebody made it. It wasn't anything to do with me. They did send me a copy. They had, unfortunately, decided to do something because they thought it would be easier, and it made a lot of the puzzles not work properly because basically the walls weren't in the same place as they were in the original game. They were further out. So they were kind of outside the doors rather than inside the doors. And some of the puzzles actually relied on them being in the right place. So the same puzzles, but a different layout. So it was let down a bit by that. But the guys that did it recognised it after they'd finished that was an error on their part.
Did they not ask you to get involved then at the development stage?
No, and I wouldn't have been interested. I mean, you know, it was a great time, but I was also, that was my job. Mm-hmm. I was making money out of it. You know, these guys were doing it for fun. And, you know, Head Over Heels was a year's work. I'm not going to put that sort of effort into something that's not going to pay its way.
Well, is there any old games that you would, like, consider revisiting again or updating?
Well, if somebody came along with the right offer. You know, the retro scene is fun, but for people to, you know, put their working lives into it, it's got to pay. Because, you know, there are always bills to be paid. somebody's got to pay for my electricity and gas. The retro scene doesn't really pay anybody.
So what are you up to nowadays?
Today? Making curtains.
Nice.
Quite a change, yeah.
We recently moved, so there's a lot of renovation going on.
You are still coding. You did like an iPhone game recently, didn't you?
I looked at one. I never completed it. So that just kind of got left by the wayside. I'm not working on the games at the moment. I mean, I program simply because I can, and sometimes it's just the easiest way to work something out. I've got, for instance, I have to put new skirting board all around this house because it's got a concrete floor, and I need to run my power lines through skirting board. It's the easy way to get them around the house because the place has sort of plugs in it. Mm. Which is pretty inconvenient. This type of trunking skirting board comes in certain lengths. So to work out how much I need, I write a program.
Nice.
That works it all out for me, tells me exactly how to cut it and all of it, because it's just, for me, the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, I'll be measuring every corner and wall. You know.
So, it's a tool for me. I'd use it any time it's convenient, just like, you pick up a pair of scissors when you want to cut a bit of paper.
Well, John, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this week.
No problem.
And if people want to keep up to date with you, have you got a website they can visit?
I updated last about 10 years ago. www.ritman.co.uk.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.